As always, it is indeed a pleasure to be with you, brethren, here, and to have an opportunity to renew acquaintances of times past and to see that indeed you have grown and that there are new faces here. And that indeed is a great encouragement to us. I was asked this morning what the title of this lesson was, and I have sometimes difficulty titling lessons, but this one is entitled The One Another's of a Happy Home. I had the opportunity to unite in marriage Friday evening two of the finest young Christian people that I've ever met. Two young people that, although they are still, in my thinking, somewhat young in years, are advanced beyond their years in wisdom and spiritual commitment. And I was asked to preach this lesson in part for their benefit a week ago Sunday, when they might be a little more in tune to listening than have these things simply presented during their wedding ceremony. But I think these things are not only important for those that are contemplating marriage, but for those of us that have been in marriages for a number of years, to remind ourselves of some very simple truths and some very simple laws of relationships that, if we follow them, will help us to have happy and peaceful homes. Happy marriages and happy homes don't happen by accident. And they certainly don't happen by following the ill-fated wisdom of the world. But rather, happy homes and happy marriages must be nurtured and carefully developed by following God's design. It was God who made man long ages ago. It was God who instituted the human family, who said that it was not good for man to live alone, and so he made a creature that was suitable for man. And there in the plush and the beautiful Garden of Eden, with the pristine purity of that garden as the backdrop, as God officiated, and as the angels witnessed, God united into a marriage and a family, Adam and Eve. And there he blessed that home and he blessed the family. And the peace and harmony that existed between them in the garden is the very same that God would have us to have today. And what God has said in ages past is as relevant and as needed today as it was when these worthies said these things. A fellow by the name of James Hastings, I don't know if it's any relation to Bruce or not, wrote the following definition of marriage as a basis for a happy home that I thought was worthy of repeating. He says, marriage is the coming together of two lives in the deepest of possible unity. It is the surrender of separate individuality and the mingling of each into a common stream. The two become one flesh. It does not rest on a civil contract like a business partnership. It rests instead on a mysterious change affecting the very substance of body and blending two lives into a physical and spiritual oneness. They then can learn to suppress self, to think how they can do and be the very best for each other. And he adds that, thank God, in many marriages, this ideal is realized. I think if we will follow those type of selfless ideals as set forth by our Lord and those that he appointed to write, indeed we'll have a blessed and a happy home. In John 13 and verse 34, Jesus gives us the first of the one another commandments that I like to suggest is the very basis and very foundation of a happy and a peaceful home. There Jesus says, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. The newness, this command, is not a chronological newness. This certainly is not the first time that God has commanded man to love his fellow. But never has there been the quality of love. Never before was man challenged to raise his love to such a height. Never before did man have such a lofty and noble example to follow as that which was set forth by Jesus Christ. In John 15 and verse 13, Jesus tells us, greater love hath no man than he that would lay down his life for his friend. Well, our Lord took that one step farther and died not just simply for his friends, but for his enemies as well. In Romans 5 and verse 8, that while we were yet the enemies of God, Christ died for us. While we were in rebellion to God, while we were unworthy and undeserving, Jesus laid down his life for us. Certainly greater love hath no man. Of all the utterances that Jesus made on the cross, there's none that amaze me anymore than the one that is recorded in Luke 23 and verse 34, where Jesus looks down upon those that have just participated in the nailing of his body to that cross. And he says, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And it was just immediately after the death of Jesus that the centurion said, "Behold, truly, he was the Son of God." Hearing that type of selflessness come from one who was dying at the hands of another, certainly it's not difficult to understand how Jesus impacted that man in the manner of his death. Such self-sacrificing love, Jesus says, is the badge of discipleship. When within our homes and in our marriages, whether husband and wife or parent or child, we begin to take on and really to nurture and develop this type of self-sacrificing love, peace and happiness will certainly follow. I think it's significant that nowhere in the Bible does God say, "Marry the one you love." But he does say, "Love the one you marry." And you may think, well, what's the difference? I think the difference is monumental. The basis of our marriage is not some type of fleeting emotion, but the basis of our relationship is a deep-seated, conscious, intellectual commitment to one another. And that whoever we are bound to, we have that obligation to love. In Ephesians 5 and verse 25, now I'm not suggesting that you're not supposed to love before you marry. Don't get me wrong. I'm just suggesting that's not the basis. And that regardless of who we marry, we love them. In Ephesians 5 and verse 25, "Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify it and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word." Husbands, love your wives. There's no choice in the matter. Just do it. This command reminds me somewhat of the Nike commercial. They talk about, you know, getting out and jogging and doing all kinds of strenuous exercise. And they say, just do it. Don't just sit around and talk about it. Don't sit around and make elaborate plans. Just go out and do it. And that's the impact of this command. Husbands, love your wives. No exemptions, no exceptions. Love your wives, whether she's pretty or just pretty ugly. Paul says, love them. Whether they're skinny or fat, a good cook or a bad cook, whether they're lovable or mean, Paul says, love them. No exemptions, no exceptions. The love of a husband for his wife is to be sacrificial, to count himself and his own interest as nothing compared to those of his wife. But the wives are not let off the hook. In Titus 2 and verse 4, the older women are told to admonish the young women to love their husbands, to love their children. And this is a part of the things that is to be learned. I think it's significant that the love that is to exist between a husband and wife is not just simply a fleeting emotion, but it is a learned, disciplined response. That by a learned, disciplined process, a wife comes to learn how to love an imperfect husband. She grows and learns to love her husband in spite of his faults and his failings, in spite of his inconsideration on times, in spite of his selfishness at times. She learns to love her husband. It's not, as we suggested, a therapy, toe-tingling, butterfly, toe-curling kind of emotional response, but a very deliberate, learned, intellectual, emotional response. There are far too many marriages today that are based upon this butterfly in the stomach infatuation. And then when the newness is gone, when the self-service is gone, then the marriage is gone. And suddenly people say, well, we fell out of love. No, you didn't fall out of love. You were never in love to begin with, and love was never developed. In far too many of the cases, infatuation is mistaken for love. I really had never thought about this until I had an opportunity to read some material that was written by a lady by the name of Colleen Kelly Mast. It was written an excellent book entitled Sex Respect that teaches chastity for young people. And she makes the comment in her book that one of the tragedies that she sees today is that because of early premarital sexual involvement and the bonding that naturally takes place in that kind of relationship, that young people often mistake infatuation for love, and they're led to marry the wrong individual. And then all of a sudden the thrill is gone, and the magic is gone, and the chemistry's gone, and all of the sweetness and spice is gone. And suddenly the reality of being married to an imperfect person faces them, and the crisis comes. The marriage crumbles, and the family is torn apart. When an emotional attachment is the basis, then that's what we can look forward to, because our emotions can be shattered far too easily. But when the basis of our relationship is the sacrificial love for one another, when we love our husbands, when we love our wives, and when wives love their husbands, and parents love their children, and children love their parents with the self-sacrificing love of Jesus Christ, there is that bond of unity that glues them and holds them together. By God's design, we do not enter into a marriage for the purpose of being loved, but rather we enter into a marriage so that we may love another. If our partner has that same determination, then we'll reach the heights of God-designed marital bliss. In Galatians chapter 2, Paul gives us another one another that has an application within God's family in a spiritual sense, but also a needed application within our physical families. Galatians 6 and verse 2, bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. The agape love that Jesus commands in John 13 demands that we look out for the interest and the concerns and the burdens of others. The vocation of burden bearing should naturally follow if we have acquired the fruit of the Spirit. In chapter 5, beginning in verse 22, we see things like love and joy and peace and long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. If we've taken on that character, then we're going to remove ourselves from ourselves and begin to look to others with far greater frequency. Paul calls upon Christians to have strong shoulders, to help carry the oppressive and weighty burdens of others. Burden bearing is said by Paul to be a fulfillment of the law of Christ, a practical expression of genuine sacrificial love. We often see sometimes perhaps you're familiar with cases where there has been a mate in a marriage, or maybe a child that has some type of physical abnormality, handicap, or defect that makes it impossible for them to care for themselves. I know of one couple where the husband has been afflicted like that from early on in their marriage, and they've been married for longer than I've been alive. And the wife has gently and patiently and lovingly nourished and cherished and helped bear the burdens of that one who could not bear his own. That's what Paul's talking about when he says, bear one another's burdens. You help me carry what I can't, and I help you carry what you can't, and together the load gets carried. If each spouse in a marriage, if parents and children determine to support the other in whatever way is needed, regardless of the burden, as we look away from ourselves to focus on the burdens of others, greater love and happiness will come into our home. Far too many people today enter marriage expect a family relationship to simply serve them. They want a marriage for what they can get out of it. When the marriage doesn't serve them, then they throw it away. You know, used to in this country, when a toaster broke, you took it down the street to whatever the name of that little fellow was, Floyd's Fix-It Shop in Mayberry. And Floyd would put a new cord on your toaster if that's what it needed. If a heating element was broke, why, he fixed it for you. He took it back home. Well, nowadays, you throw it away, you go to Kmart or Walmart. In our case, you go to Walmart. Because it's easier and it's quicker and often cheaper. And there's nothing wrong with throwing a toaster away. But we've allowed this mentality of throw away toasters and throw away diapers and throw away milk cartons to influence us to where now we throw away marriages, we throw away families, we throw away babies because they're not convenient, because it isn't going to serve our interests. We live in perhaps the most selfish, materialistic society that the earth has ever held. And we see people bailing out of marriages every day because their mate is not going to be their personal servant. And yet that's not the picture of marriage at all. In a recent Good Morning America series, they were talking about unfaithfulness in marriage. And toward the end of the series, a marriage counselor stated something that he said was needed in America today. In flash of light, it took a brilliant man with a PhD who had studied at hundreds or dozens of Ivy-covered universities to finally come up with what God said years ago. This man said that we need to rethink the institution of marriage in America, to begin to see it as a means of service and not as a means of being served. Isn't that what God said a long time ago? Amazing how long it takes some people to come around to the wisdom of God. If we serve one another, if we think more highly of one another than we do of ourselves, then indeed we can have a happy home and a happy marriage. In Ephesians 4 and verse 2, along with love and burden bearing, we see another one another that's certainly needed in every family today. In Ephesians 4 and verse 2, with all lowliness and gentleness, with long suffering, bearing with one another in love. Forbearance, long suffering, patience is a part of the Christian's worthy walk. Now, husbands, are there any of you here tonight who have been married over a week who wouldn't agree that there are times that your wife tests your patience? It happens, doesn't it? And wives, isn't it true that those imperfect husbands test your patience? Our children test our patience. And I suppose at times we have to admit that we as parents test the patience of our children as well. Where would we be without patience, long-suffering, this willingness to restrain and resign ourselves so that in love we hold up under the faults and the failings of others? Not that we passively accept them, not that we become enablers of one another's faults, but we resign ourselves, we control ourselves, and in meekness and patience, we restrain ourselves from acting in our own self-interests. Sometimes we see parents who, because they want to be patient and long-suffering, allow their children to go undisciplined, and then in later years wondered where they went wrong. 2 weeks ago on Friday, I had the opportunity to spend all day at a place that I hope I never, ever see anyone that I know unless they're in the audience. I spent all day at a place called Possibilities Unlimited that is a, quote, Christian drug and alcohol rehabilitation center for teenagers and young adults. At lunchtime, they had seven of the clients there that put on a skit. And by the way, out of those seven, only one came from a broken home. Four out of the seven were active weekly in some type of denominational youth group. Three of the four boys were outstanding varsity athletes. Two out of the three girls were honor students in their high school. They looked like my kids. They looked like your kids. You could have taken any one of those seven, put them in this room, and they wouldn't have stood out from the crowd. I was expecting these kids with, you know, long, greasy hair, and 17 or 18 earrings going up one ear, and one great big one hanging down here, and more bandanas than Aunt Jemima, and slits all over their jeans, and mismatched. I was expecting, you know, this greasy, slimy mess. They were rosy-cheeked, clean-cut kids that looked like our neighbors and our kids. And after the skit, the director asked them, he said, look, Molly's laughing. That the one character does look like our neighbors, at least one of them. But after the skit was over, the director asked them some questions. We got to ask them questions as well. One lady asked him, said, is there anything that your parents could have done to have prevented your drug and alcohol problems? They gave two suggestions that just blew me away. All of them said the same two things. One, trust us less. And two, be harder on us. All of them said their parents knew we were lying. They knew we couldn't have the flu and come in and throw up all over the floor as often as we did. But they believed us. They covered for us when we didn't do well in school or we got in trouble. They became enablers. Sometimes if we're not careful, we began to get a warped and a false sense of what patience and long-suffering is. God was patient and long-suffering with Israel, and yet he disciplined them. In marriages, as in homes, and in churches. Proper exercise of discipline, tempered with patience and meekness, will lead to a greater unity. As long as homes are made up of human beings, patience is going to be needed. I found a little poem that I think expresses a good thought between parents and their children. It says, oh, give me patience when little hands tug at me with ceaseless small demands. Oh, give me gentle words and smiling eyes, and keep my lips from hasty, sharp replies. Let me not in weariness, confusion, or noise obscure my vision from life's few fleeting joys. Then when in years to come my house is still, no bitter memories its rooms may fill. One of the saddest things that I have ever had to do is to go into a home where a teenager has become rebellious and left home. Or maybe a young adult has left the church. They've gone out to live a godless lifestyle. And you sit down with the parent who now has an empty bedroom, and they stare into the emptiness of their room, and with tears in their eyes as they clutch their breast, they say, where did I go wrong? And the bitterness of the memories overpower them. Well, we need to recognize that our children have their own free will. That it's certainly possible for children to rebel regardless of the excellence of our training. But yet, if we are not patient and loving and forbearing with them, we set them up for disaster and make the disaster far easier for them. If we fly off the handle or constantly nag, our impatience is going to be a disruption to the harmony that God intended for the home. With patience and forbearance, we need to be quick to forgive one another. As we bond ourselves together in love, we need to be subject to one another, Ephesians 5 and verse 21. And that includes the husband to the wife and the wife to the husband. We recognize that the husband indeed serves in a functional position of leadership, but he does so with consideration of his wife's needs, with a willingness to submit to her desires. We are in 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 21 encouraged to build one another up, to encourage one another. We ought then to mark our every word in action and judge our every word in action by whether it builds or destroys, whether it encourages or whether it defeats. A fellow named of Judge Sabbath, who was for a long time a divorce court judge, framed the following 10 commandments for a successful home. He said, first and foremost, bear and forbear. Work together, play together, grow together. Avoid the little quarrels, and the big ones will take care of themselves. Compromise, give and take, he says, is the antitoxin of divorce. Practice sympathy, good humor, and mutual understanding. Don't grouch before breakfast. And my kids would tell you the only way for that to be true in our house is if they leave the house before breakfast and they don't have to face Dad. He says, don't grouch before breakfast or even after breakfast. Respect your in-laws, but don't criticize them or take criticism from them. Establish your own home, even if it's in a one-room flat. Fight for each other, but not with each other. Build your home on religious faith with love and forgiveness as the watchword. If in our homes and families we clear our minds of all of the garbage that the world feeds it each day, peace and joy and love can reign therein. I had the opportunity a couple of months ago to go down to Neon, Kentucky. Well, I thought I had been to the end of the world when I went up to Tintown, but I found the end of the world is a few miles farther than that. I was there for a funeral, and on the way down, I went past a little place, probably near Happy. It was about in that area, somewhere down, just a little place past Hazard. And up on top of a little hill, there was a little white church building. And down at the bottom, somebody had taken a 55-gallon drum and turned it sideways, cut it in half, put hinges and a handle on it, put it up on stilts, and it said, "Church Garbage." Now, that's a great idea. Because you drive in, you open the lid, you open your lid, dump out all your garbage, close your lid, close that lid, you drive on up the hill and worship in peace. And how great it would be if we could just stop and dump all the garbage out of our head before we went to worship with one another. How peaceful things would be. And how that would work if every day, before we as husbands come home from work, we stop at the door, we flip our lid, we dump out our garbage, close the lid, and then we walk in. We'll not be what Zig Ziglar called the cat-kicking fool. And the fellow that got up late, got chewed out for being late when he got to work, the secretary spilled coffee on him. He took an important client to lunch. The lunch was late. It was cold. He lost the account. He had a flat tire on the way home. Then ran out of gas. He walks in the house, opens the door. The cat runs across, and he kicks the cat. Who's that poor cat? Don't they know they didn't buy him? Calling the cat-kicking fool. Sometimes we are that way in our faith, but we just stop and dump all that garbage out. You think, when I walk in, I'm going to selflessly love everybody in this. That whatever problems they have today, I'm going to put mine behind me, and I'm going to help them with theirs. Regardless of what's going on, I'm going to grit my teeth and be patient. I'm going to try to build them up. I'm going to try to make them better when they go to bed at night than when they got up today. And we'll have the kind of homes that God will have us to have. Our marriages, our families, our communities will be richer and better for them. The one family you need to be most concerned about is the family of God. If you're not a part of that family, Brother Jim could not have made God's plan of salvation any clearer this morning than he did. If that's your desire tonight. If you want to respond to Jesus, having believed in him and the Father, having been called by the gospel, to repent of your sins and confess your faith in Jesus and be baptized tonight. Won't you do this? Together we stand and sing.